You should have never stopped selling drugs in Fairhaven. That was a detective. New Haven Police Department, to be exact. He was on the clock. He was in a police station. And most importantly, he was speaking to a man he was processing for arrest. His name was Vincent Rauchy Jr. And what he meant by that sentence is the subject of everything you're about to hear. Welcome to the Hidden Ledger Podcast. The title of this episode is A Settling of Accounts. New Haven, Connecticut. 135,000 people. Home to Yale, a few excellent pizza places, and 4% of the state's population. It has also produced more than 40% of Connecticut's wrongful convictions. That number is not a typo. And it is also not a coincidence. This is Chapter 1. Act 1. Both of them. Here is a useful thing to know about Detective Vincent Rauchy Jr. He was, by all available accounts, very good at his job. Both of them, in fact. For approximately 15 years, from around 1981 to 1996, Rauchy worked as a New Haven police officer. Narcotic squad first, then detective. His colleague, Von Mayer, would later call him a hard-nosed cop with great street information. And he was right. Rauchy's street information? It was extraordinary. It was also purchased with a second paycheck from Frank Parisi, New Haven's most prominent drug kingpin, a cocaine trafficker with organized crime connections, who ran his operation out of Quinnipiac Avenue. FBI documents paint a picture that might be funny if the consequences weren't measured in human lives. A working detective who warned drug dealers when their own department was about to raid them. Who used crack cocaine with associates at a Clay Street apartment on his off hours. And who drove a city-issued police vehicle to crack houses before dawn. A man collecting a public salary to enforce the laws he was breaking before breakfast. On one side of the ledger, Vincent Rauchy Jr. carried a badge. On the other, he owed his loyalty, and apparently his weekday evenings, to a man the federal government would eventually convict of trafficking more than 5 kilos of cocaine. The arrangement? It worked beautifully. Right up until someone tried to leave. Scott Lewis owed $10,000 in cocaine debt to Parisi and to Vinny. He was a low-level dealer in Fairhaven. The kind of small player who exists in every drug network, but as a revenue line. Not a name. At some point, Lewis decided to stop selling and to pursue a career in real estate. He was approximately 25 years old. He had no violent criminal record. But in the economy that Rauchy operated in, walking away from a debt was not a career transition. It was an insult. And when Lewis was brought in for processing, Rauchy delivered the line that sits at the top of this episode. You should have never stopped selling drugs in Fairhaven. A drug enforcement detective, on the clock, in a police station telling a suspect that his real crime was quitting the trade. What came next was not justice. It was construction. The blueprint. On October 11th, 1990, someone shot former New Haven alderman Ricardo Turner and his lover Lamont Fields in their bed at 634 Howard Avenue. It was a high-profile case. A former city official, a double homicide, no arrest. The case went cold for 4 years. Then Rauchy took over the investigation, and in 1994, the architecture began. Now, a good frame job, right? The kind that survives appeals. The kind that holds up for 2 decades. It requires materials. You need witnesses who will say what you need them to say, and they need to sound like they mean it. The trick is knowing where to shop. Rauchy found Ruiz. Ruiz was a teenager. He had schizophrenia. He had a criminal record. And most importantly, he had no firsthand knowledge whatsoever of who killed Ricardo Turner and Lamont Fields. He was, in other words, the perfect raw material. Someone with enough proximity to the streets to seem plausible, and enough vulnerability to be shaped. During the interrogation, Rauchy fed Ruiz the details. Not some of the details. I mean, the details. The kind only the killer or the investigating officers would know. And piece by piece, prompt by prompt, Rauchy constructed a witness the way that a carpenter might construct a cabinet. Measure, cut, fit, and fasten. The testimony that emerged from that room, well, let's just say it sounded like memory. Now, this was not a subtle operation. Detective Sergeant Michael Sweeney was supervising. He watched it happen. He pulled Rauchy out of the room and told him directly to stop coaching the witness. What happened next? Rauchy walked right back in, and he kept going. Later, when Sweeney asked Ruiz why he'd said what he'd said, the answer came out without artifice. Because Detective Rauchy said I'd go home if I tell him what happened, so I just wanted to get out of there. He was a teenager. He had schizophrenia. He wanted to go home. The man who wouldn't cooperate. Now, one coach witness puts a case together, but architecture requires load-bearing walls. And Rauchy wanted the structure to hold, so he went looking for another piece. Someone who could place Scott Lewis at the scene, but from a different angle. He found Stefan Moran. The approach, it was more personal this time. Rauchy called Moran's mother first, establishing the stakes, making sure the family understood that cooperation was expected. Then he arranged a face-to-face meeting at a gas station. The proposition was straightforward. Testify against Lewis, say you were there, say you drove the car. Moran said no. He would not put a lie on a man he knew was innocent. Not for a deal, not for a detective, and not for his own safety. Now, when a material doesn't bend the way that you need it to, you have 2 options. You can either find a different material, or you can make it part of the structure anyway. Rauchy chose the second. When Morant refused to be a witness, Rauchy made him a defendant. The getaway driver for a murder Morant had nothing to do with. pinned on a man who also had nothing to do with it. On June 8th, 1994, Stephane Marat was convicted. 70 years. Scott Lewis was convicted the following spring. 120. Between them, 190 years of prison sentences. Two innocent men, a case built entirely from coached testimony, coerced witnesses, and suppressed evidence. Assembled by a detective who was simultaneously employed by the city of New Haven and by a cocaine trafficker. The architecture held. Act 2. What the FBI found and what it didn't do. The FBI learned about Rauchy in the summer of 1995. A confidential informant, source NH3195-0, told Special Agent William Rainier Jr. that Rauchy was using crack cocaine regularly. The Bureau opened a corruption investigation. Case file 194C-NH-32550, formally titled Police Officer Vincent Rauchy, New Haven Police Department, Public Corruption. Over the next 18 months, agents conducted dozens of interviews. They spoke with Ruiz, they spoke with Marat, they spoke with Parisi. They even sat down with Rauchy himself, twice, in 1996. A federal judge would later describe what the investigation produced as substantial evidence that Rauchy had coerced and improperly coached witnesses. But the FBI didn't stop at the Turner Fields case. The investigation, as the Hartford Courant reported in its April 2000 expose, uncovered accusations against Rauchy's motives in at least five other cases. Five other cases. Not named, not detailed, and not ultimately prosecuted. The Department of Justice reviewed the FBI's evidence, and they declined to bring charges. The reason entered into the record? So many of those interviewed had questionable backgrounds. The witnesses that Rauchy had coerced, the addicts that he'd leveraged, the teenagers he'd coached, the people the system had already marked as disposable, were now too compromised to testify against him. The damage that he inflicted on the people around him became, in the DOJ's calculation, his best defense. Lewis stayed in prison. Marat stayed in prison. And on April 11, 1996, Rauchy resigned from the force, just ahead of the police commission's ability to fire him. Also, keeping eligibility for a $28,000 a year pension. Even Mayer, the colleague who'd called him hard-nosed, conceded to the Courant. There have been so many accusations. It's becoming a chore to come in here and defend him. I mean, when there is so much said about a cop, a red flag has to go up. Well, the flag went up. Nobody saluted. Nobody investigated further. Nobody pulled the files on those five unnamed cases, you know, to see who else might be sitting in a cell on manufactured evidence. Rauchy walked out the door, and the machine kept running. Act 3, the part they don't want you to see. Here's what I can tell you now. It's not the full picture. That comes in the chapters ahead. But it is enough to understand the shape of what happened. Vincent Rauchy, he didn't operate alone. The tactics he used in the Lewis and Marat case, the coached witnesses, the coerced testimony, the suppressed evidence, appear again and again across more than a dozen wrongful convictions in New Haven, spanning two decades. The same methods and in case after case, a small rotation of names in the detective files. Rauchy's name is in some of those files. So are others. Detectives who worked in pairs, who built cases in the same neighborhoods, who targeted the same kind of defendants, using the same playbook. One of them even admitted under oath in a federal courtroom that it was his general practice to omit exculpatory information from affidavits. His general practice. To routinely leave out evidence that could have cleared the people he was helping to convict. The way another professional might describe their habit of just filing reports on time. That detective is dead now. But in February of 2026, just weeks ago, someone who knew him intimately, someone with a law enforcement career of their own, voluntarily walked into the Connecticut State Capitol and confirmed everything. We'll get to that. For now, understand the scope. Adam Carman was convicted of murdering a 7-month-old baby girl. He served 28 years. No physical evidence ever linked him to the crime. The eyewitnesses saw the shooter for 3 seconds, at night. George Gould served roughly 26 years on the word of a single witness. That witness would later testify that police bought her heroin to keep her cooperating. Troy Streeter, he spent 23 years in prison for a murder he had a church alibi for. Every witness against him has since recanted. Every single one. These are not the only names. There are more. Co-defendants, brothers convicted together, men whose cell phone records prove they were never at the scene. Men who are still incarcerated right now, while witnesses recant from the other side of the wall. Every single one of them is black. Every single case was built in the same neighborhoods, The Hill, Fairhaven, New Hallville, Dixwell, by detectives using the same blueprint Rauchy drew up in that interrogation room with Ruiz. New Haven is home to 4% of Connecticut's population. It has also produced more than 40% of its wrongful convictions. Last September, a federal judge examined the body of evidence across these cases and put into writing what no court had been willing to say before, that this was not just one bad cop and not a string of isolated mistakes, but something systematic. A finding the city cannot dismiss as coincidence, and in a cascade of federal civil rights lawsuits, it cannot afford and cannot settle fast enough. The architecture of this lie was built over 20 years, and it is still coming down. And the people trapped inside, some of them for decades, some of them still, are the ones who paid for every brick. Two men are in a prison on a case built from this blueprint. Scott Lewis, the man Rauchy punished for leaving the drug trade, will spend 19 years in a cell before a federal judge what 7 state judges would not. Stephane Moran, the man who refused to lie, will serve 21 years for that refusal. What it took to get them out, what it cost, and what became the detective who put them there. That's next time. A Settling of Accounts is a production of the Hidden Ledger podcast. This investigation draws on reporting by the Hartford Courant, New Haven Independent, CT Mirror, the Yale Investigative Reporting Lab, and court filings in the United States District Court for the District of Connecticut. Full source citations are available at thenightauditor.com. If this investigation matters to you, subscribe wherever you listen, share it with someone, and join the companion newsletter at substack.com for documents, source material, and updates between episodes. Thanks for listening.